If Russia crosses this line, there will be catastrophic consequences for Russia. The United States will respond decisively.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan warns Russia against using nuclear weapons. It's Monday, September 26th, and this is Here and Now Anytime from NPR and WBUR Boston. I'm Chris Bentley. Today on the show, we've got four stories for you, including a look at where abortion laws have changed since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade in June, and how the former head of Mississippi's welfare agency embezzled tens of millions of dollars meant for the state's poorest residents. But first, some Russians are fleeing their country after President Vladimir Putin initiated a draft of more than 300,000 new troops to fight the war in Ukraine. And today, a 25-year-old Russian man opened fire at a military recruiting station in Siberia. NPR's Charles Maines told Scott Tong, it's not the only such attack.
He was apparently, his family members say, he was upset over his best friend with no military experience being drafted to go fight in Ukraine. This comes amid previous attacks, arsonist attacks, really, on a dozen or so other government buildings and recruitment centers around the country since Putin made this call up last week for reservists. And even today, we saw another event in Ryazan. This is just outside of Moscow. A potential recruit lit himself on fire outside the central bus station. So certainly a sense that there is deep turmoil in the country related to the conflict in Ukraine and this call-up of troops.
Who is being called up, Charles? What do we know about them? How many?
Well, remember, Putin framed this call-up as a partial mobilization, those are his words, of reservists, really with military experience or necessary skills. So, for example, medical doctors for field work. This applies to anyone aged 18 to 60, in theory men and women, although, of course, most are men. The defense ministry says they want 300,000 to join the fight in the call-up in the near soon. Although many believe that final number is much, much higher. But draft papers are being issued already, somewhat randomly, I should say. Evidence is such that even those with no military background have been issued draft papers to show up. And evidence also that a lot of these draft papers are being issued in towns and cities with to the less educated, often ethnic minorities, disproportionately. So there certainly doesn't seem to be a fair kind of distribution across Russian society as a whole.
And all this has led to protests that we've been seeing, you've been seeing across the country. What has the government response been?
Well, you're right. I mean, there've been dozens of protests over the weekend. For example, I was observing one in Moscow. Police seem well in place to make arrests, not only of demonstrators, but just kind of random people watching. There have been 2,200 arrests since Putin made this call up last week. And those who are arrested face possible prison sentences for denigrating the armed forces here. That's under new laws that exist, as well as possibly supposedly attacking police. We've seen other men who've been of conscription age who've been arrested at these protests being issued draft papers on the spot. And for that reason, on Saturday, it certainly seemed to me, from what I saw, that many of the people out there were women. So we also saw a similar event in Dagestan in the south of Russia, where women seemed to lead the charge. There were 100 people arrested there. And in fact, that seems to have set off even more clashes today between protesters and police. And all of this, you know, suggests that Putin has not convinced many of the necessity of mobilization, particularly after months of claiming everything was going, quote, according to plan, and insisting this is not a war, but a special limited military operation. So now he says it's an existential battle against the West, and a lot of people seem to be asking, well, which one is it? And why should we be the ones sacrificing?
It's also been reported that more than 260,000 men, according to an independent Russian newspaper, who have fled Russia since the announcement of this conscription, this draft. Any chance Moscow could close its borders to stop them from leaving?
That certainly seems to be the rumor, even though the Kremlin denied it again today. Nonetheless, we saw Russian troops set up a checkpoint at the Georgian border, so it's the border with Russia and Georgia in the west, where thousands have been trying to flee. We certainly see these long lines of cars to the border of Finland, to the Mongolia and Kazakhstan in the south, even a small border with Norway and the Arctic Circle in the north. And flights are sold out or very expensive to countries with visa-free travel, and they're certainly being booked up all by young conscription-aged men. So even without a full travel ban so far, it certainly seems very difficult for conscription-aged men to leave this country right now.
That's NPR's Charles Maines talking to us from Moscow. Charles, thanks again.
Hey, thank you.
Russia is also holding what it's calling referenda in occupied regions of Ukraine on whether to officially become part of the Russian Federation. Over the weekend, there were reports of soldiers going door-to-door to collect votes. Putin has threatened to use nuclear weapons if Ukrainian forces encroach on supposedly Russian territory. And Robin Young asks here now security analyst Jim Walsh for his thoughts. He's a senior research associate at the MIT Security Studies Program.
Am I concerned? Yes, I am concerned. First of all, you know, no matter who you are, whether you're an expert or a knowledgeable NPR listener, all of us have been surprised by some developments at some point in this war. So while it's true that the use of nuclear weapons is a low probability, we should not be so confident in our assumptions, especially given the stakes. As you said, he's threatened the use. He's had his own version of nuclear alerts. And now this final thing of, you know, grabbing someone else's land, saying it's yours, and saying we're going to defend it with nuclear weapons. Well, the problem with that is those assertions obviously are not credible, and no one's going to back down in the face of them. So now Putin has put himself in a situation where he has to follow through or embarrass himself by not following through on the threat. And in either case, all of this together is eating away at what might be called the nuclear rules of the road that have been in place for decades. So whether it's Ukraine today or something else tomorrow, it is not moving in a positive direction.
Do you think, though, it's eating away at his rule of Russia? I mean, this isn't the Soviet Union anymore. He's not in the KGB anymore. But I think we're seeing more protests, you know, lingering than we have. So what happens there?
Well, I think we're facing a basic conundrum here. Everyone wants Russia out of Ukraine and Russian defeated and out. And the closer we come to that, and the more threatening it is to Putin's continued governance and staying in power, the more dicey things become. So the thing we want necessarily means some risk here that Putin may make yet another mistake and become desperate at some point.
Yeah. Well, go to Iran, where protests continue this weekend over the death earlier this month of the 22-year-old who died in police custody after being seized by the morality police. Let's just listen to the sounds there. People were yelling things like, I don't want my headscarf, and, you know, they want death to the rulers there. You were at the General Assembly last week. You spoke with President Raisi and, after his speech. You spoke with him. Yeah. What did he have to say about those protests?
Well, I was with a small group of Americans who met with the Iranian president there in New York. I've been doing this for 15 years. I've met with every Iranian president since Khatami. And the 10 of us asked a bunch of questions. And certainly one of the questions that was aggressively pursued was the question surrounding these protests. Now, I'm not going to say anything in this meeting that he hasn't already said out loud, but I'll say that he was withholding, his position was, quote, withholding judgment until the judicial branch investigates the woman's death. But he did wonder out loud, oh, perhaps maybe she died of other natural causes. Mm. So, you know, he's playing it either way, sort of saying, we'll wait for the official report. But he, in recent days, he's certainly been clearly condemning the protests.
Well, we've seen these huge waves of protests before in 2009 over a corrupt election in the late 2000s. You know, gas prices was one that triggered some. And there's always this moment of maybe this will be the moment when the regime will be deposed. But then it's violently and brutally put down. What's your sense now?
Well, I think the protests reflect real grievances by different parts of society. You know, there's this morality police issue and the woman who died in custody. But broadly speaking, there are economic problems from sanctions and mismanagement, COVID, climate change. The anger is real, but it's not really connected to a political program with a specific demand. So I think it's going to be hard to sustain, especially since the authorities have the ability to suppress it.
And we only have a few seconds here, but there's a lot of talk about renewing the deal that would restrict Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. What did the president say at the General Assembly?
He was open to it. But I think the reality is all the sides see it's in their national interest to do it, but there's no political payoff. They're not exactly enthusiastic about it. My guess is we'll see something in November.
Jim Walsh, Senior Research Associate at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Security Studies Program. Here now is Resident Security Analyst. Jim, we always thank you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, it's been 3 months since the Supreme Court took away federal abortion rights. We'll take a look at where state laws stand. Protesters in Arizona this weekend after a judge there allowed a Civil War-era abortion ban to take effect. It's a different story in Indiana, where last week a judge blocked that state's newly passed ban. Robin Young called up the Washington Post's Rachel Rubin to help us take stock of where state laws on abortion stand 3 months after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade.
This pre-Roe ban was allowed to take effect this weekend, and that ban does not allow for exceptions for rape and incest. It does have exceptions for when a pregnant patient's life is at risk. So that is the latest in Arizona.
Well, and you say, you know, it was a Civil War era ban, but it was set aside in 1973 when Roe v. Wade was passed. So now it's just been reactivated in Arizona. We know Arizona's Republican governor supported a comparatively more moderate 15-week ban on abortions. The state legislature passed that, but that is now moot, right?
So Governor Ducey, as you mentioned, had previously, before the judge ruling, had insisted that the 15-week ban was the law of the land. But what we did see on Friday was that the Arizona judge did revive the ban on abortion that dates back to the mid-19th century.
Okay, so that is now the law in Arizona. And you mentioned it does have an exception to save the life of a mother. But we're also reading that doctors are leaving the state in anticipation of these restrictions. Is there a sense that women might not get the care they need?
In general, just kind of looking at the landscape since the Supreme Court's ruling, there's been a nationwide shift in, you know, providers in states that are generally Democratic, seeing an influx of patients from Republican-led states, generally speaking, where there are restrictions on abortion. And just kind of looking at the general landscape, there's roughly 15 states across the country with bans in effect. Now, that includes most of those are near total bans. You know, that also includes ones that are at around roughly 6 weeks or 15 weeks as well.
Now, so abortions are not stopping as much as women are crossing state borders to get the help they need in other states. And that reminds us of Indiana. We remember the story of the 10-year-old rape victim who traveled from Ohio to Indiana to have an abortion. Then Indiana passed restrictive laws, and now a judge in Indiana has ruled that abortions there must resume. Have they?
So a near total ban on abortion went into effect in Indiana earlier this month. And as you mentioned, a judge last week did allow abortions to resume, temporarily blocked that near total ban.
Okay. Well, we know West Virginia also joined Indiana when Indiana did pass tough new abortion restrictions, as we said. That's been stayed in Indiana. But what's the latest from West Virginia?
Governor Jim Justice signed that law, which prohibited nearly all abortions, with some exceptions to save the woman's life or in the cases of rape or incest, as long as the victim reports the crime. Now, that ban went into effect earlier this month, though the criminal penalties won't be enforced for 90 days.
Yeah. Let's look at South Carolina. The question there is whether state lawmakers will pass some kind of so-called heartbeat legislation. It bans abortions after fetal cardiac activity has been detected. Of course, critics of that say that that's often not a fetal heartbeat. It's some other kind of sound, but it's usually around 6 weeks into a pregnancy. Lawmakers want to add new restrictions in South Carolina?
So in South Carolina, the House is going to reconvene this week, and what they're looking at is an amended version of that roughly 6-week ban. South Carolina does already have a ban after roughly 6 weeks that's been temporarily blocked by the state Supreme Court. So what this bill does that the South Carolina House will consider this week is it includes some new provisions, such as limiting abortions in the cases of rape and incest to the first trimester and requiring a second doctor's opinion in cases where a fetus is diagnosed with a lethal anomaly. And there will be kind of a lot of focus at the beginning of the year on kind of what upcoming state legislatures do on abortion.
Rachel Rubine covers health and abortion for The Washington Post. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, what does former NFL star Brett Favre have to do with one of the largest corruption cases in Mississippi history? That's after the break. State officials in Mississippi took tens of millions of dollars in welfare money meant for the state's poorest residents and instead doled it out to connected firms and cronies. That's the case state and federal prosecutors are making now, and it involves former Green Bay Packers quarterback Brett Favre. Now, Favre has not been criminally charged with any wrongdoing, but the court case has revealed text messages he sent pressing officials for some of that money to build a volleyball stadium for his daughter at the University of Southern Mississippi. Anna Wolf has been covering this story for years as a reporter for Mississippi Today, and she told Robin Young that the former director of Mississippi's welfare agency has pleaded guilty.
So the welfare department had been run by this man named John Davis, and he had been pushing out a lot of these federal funds from a federal fund called Temporary Assistance for Needy Families to two nonprofits, which were supposed to be providing services to people in need across the state. John Davis has since pled guilty to his role in misspending this money, as well as the nonprofit founder, Nancy New.
And by the way, Davis has admitted to, for instance, spending thousands of dollars on a friend's son's rehab, setting up phony jobs for people. And the consequences are high. I mean, he could be serving a lot of time in jail, but he has said he'll talk.
That's right. Yeah, he is crucial to this case because John Davis is one of the characters who might have some of the best direct information about former Governor Phil Bryant's role in how this money was administered in the state.
Yeah. Well, talk about Brett Favre, just part of this huge scandal, but there are text messages revealed a while ago that show he was communicating with Davis.
Yeah, so this federal fund was basically no strings attached money that the state could spend on virtually whatever it wanted. And so Brett Favre knew that he could go to these welfare officials, to the governor, and ask for this money, and they would be able to spend it on his pet projects. So you saw in text messages that were recently entered into court that he was very persistent, almost badgering these officials about providing money for a volleyball stadium at the University of Southern Mississippi, where his daughter played volleyball.
Well, and there were text messages that were revealed weeks ago saying, you know, can you hide this money that you give me? Things like that. Well, we also have this court filing now from former Governor Phil Bryant, which includes more text messages. What's the former governor trying to communicate here?
Right. So a few weeks ago, within a sort of court battle over a subpoena that's been issued on the former governor, the attorney for Nancy New, who issued the subpoena, is attempting to get the former governor to comply and has produced all of these text messages essentially to show the public and the court, here are some things that might exist in terms of Phil Bryant's communication around how this volleyball facility got completed. Phil Bryant has now responded, producing even more text messages in an attempt to show that while he may have communicated about the volleyball facility with Brett Favre, that he didn't know that the money that they were using to construct the facility was welfare money.
Yeah. Is Brett Favre expected to make the same case?
Brett Favre's main defense at this point has been that he didn't know that the money came from welfare. It's becoming a little thin with some of the ways that they communicated. You know, by the end, near the end of construction in 2019, Phil Bryant communicated to Brett Favre that this money was supposed to be used, you know, to solve poverty. And yet he continued to press the officials in an attempt to get the funding before Governor Phil Bryant left office in early 2020.
And by the way, how much did the volleyball stadium that Brett Favre wanted primarily for his daughter, how much did that cost?
It was $5 million that went from the welfare fund to the volleyball facility. Brett Favre himself also received an additional $1.1 million from the welfare program, which we now know from the text messages was another way to get more money to the volleyball stadium. So depending on whether or not he actually used that money for the volleyball stadium, it appears around $6 million in welfare funds that went to build this building.
What are people there saying, just briefly?
So, you know, a lot of people finding out about Brett Favre's involvement in this scandal are not necessarily surprised that he would have been pushing officials in this way. But, you know, that $5 million could have been life-changing to people in poverty. I mean, even people in Hattiesburg, in the community where this volleyball facility was built, there are, you know, high poverty rates and people going to these service organizations that could have been supported with these dollars and not being able to receive, for example, their light bill assistance or rental assistance. I talked to a guy in Hattiesburg who had his child taken away from him 5 years prior to this volleyball facility being built. And he told me that he was homeless at the time and he needed housing in order to get his child back. And going to the service organizations, he was unable to get that rental assistance and he never was able to get his child back.
Oh. That's Anna Wolf, a reporter for Mississippi Today. Anna, thank you for your work on this story, and we'll continue to follow it.
Thank you so much for having me.
This podcast comes from the team behind Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston. We've got a lot more from our radio show at hereandnow.org. Check out Emiko Tamagawa and Robin Young's interview with two of the subjects of Stranger at the Gate, a new documentary about a U.S. Marine who plotted a terrorist attack on an Islamic center in Indiana, but was turned around by the kindness and respect he was shown there.
That's when I finally realized that the Muslims that were shooting at me and wanting to kill me were not the representatives of Islam. It was geopolitical. Yeah. You know, I knew that my idea of what a Muslim was the wrong one.
Today's stories were produced by Gabrielle Healy, Thomas Danielian, Lynn Menegon, and Julia Corcoran. Todd Munt and Gabe Bullard edited the show. Our technical directors are Mike Moschetto and Max Liebman. Theme music by Mike and Max, along with me, Chris Bentley. The executive producer of Here and Now is Carlene Watson. Thanks for listening. See you tomorrow.